Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, October 7th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include, how safe is medical treatment today?
And how do MDs balance home and work challenges?
Oh boy.
How does anybody?
I can tell you about that for sure. And does ownership spur unnecessary MRIs?
What factors lead to early readmissions to hospitals?
And is urban agriculture really necessary or even realistic in today's world?
You know, it's getting scarier and scarier to be hospitalized. So when you need a hospital procedure or surgery and they want to get you in and out quickly, actually it might not be such a bad idea for more reasons than the money the health insurance companies are saving by discharging you quickly. Now, Harvard School of Public Health just released the results of a new study showing that 43 million people per year are harmed by unsafe medical care. That's big.
Right. Well, you have to keep in mind that's a global number. That's not just here in the U.S. But the numbers here in the U.S. are big enough. I mean, we know we have about 1 million deaths every year that are caused in some way or related to the work that happens from the medical profession. That's a huge number. We're looking at just 400,000 deaths from medications. And about 100,000 of those effects from medications are the expected side effects, and that's just in the hospital. Doesn't include what's outside the hospital.
Isn't it interesting that we don't hear about it very much?
Well,
you know, in the news, we don't hear about it. But if people were killed, if people were killed in those numbers by other means, like from guns or from terrorists or from chemical warfare or from whatever.
Even 9/11, there were only a few thousand deaths. That happens almost every day in this country.
But, I mean, that's awful. But think about this atrocity.
Well, it's part of what happens when you accept something as status quo and right, and you don't question it. So it just becomes the way you think about things and say, well, that's just the way it is.
Just sort of swept under the carpet.
Oh, look at the whole story just on NSAIDs. You know, things like Advil and Celebrex and Aleve and Motrin. There are about 30,000 deaths every year from that. And yet when you talk to a lot of...
Yeah, and people are giving it to their...
And that's just in this country.
And people are giving it to their babies.
Oh, I know. And so you're looking at that, and it's like people will say, well, what are we supposed to do about pain? We have to take something. And the question is, do you really? Are there other ways to manage it? Is medicine the way to go? Is that the safest way to deal with our health issues? And the answer is clearly not.
Well, it also depends on what kind of pain you're having, because some pain is there and it's chronic and it's annoying.
Okay.
And then there's other pain that's unbearable.
Well, look at some of the drugs that are used to manage pain. Things like the tumor necrosis factor blockers, things like Humira and Enbrel, and drugs that are related to it. One person in 33, if they take it for 5 years, will die from that, let alone all the other kinds of side effects that you see. And yet you still see people like Phil Mickelson on TV saying, boy, it sure helped my psoriatic arthritis, and I'm so glad I'm taking it. How would he feel if something went wrong? That's why we shouldn't have celebrities endorsing things when they're not experts. So this business of how serious are the complications of what we do in medicine is a huge thing that we've just come to accept as how life is.
Well, maybe we should talk about some of the causes when you're in the hospital.
Well, that's according to these people in their study, too, and they only looked at some things. And
well, first of all, there's medicines. We just talked about medicines.
Yeah, well, that you can't overstress the importance of the complications of medicines. And then there are things like infections of the urinary tract. Not a huge thing there. That doesn't cause huge disability.
But it's annoying to you if you get a urinary tract infection from a catheter.
I remember what that's like. It takes about 4 to 6 weeks after a catheter's been in there because you had a surgery of some kind before things come back to normal, at least for a guy. And then they're talking about catheters that go into the veins that cause infections that can be real serious problems, or hospital-acquired pneumonias, or blood clots that develop because of you're sedentary and you're not exercising.
And a lot of people in hospitals fall. They mm-hmm. try to get out of bed, and
sure.
they're under the influence of their medication.
Oh,
or
they may be on
20
or 30
reason.
Drugs at one time, and I'm sure there are a lot of psychological effects that come from that.
And people that are in the hospital a long time many times get bed sores, and then you can get some of these MRSA infections. Not
sure.
just MRSA, but, you
C.
know,
diff.
C. diff. Yeah.
Yeah, there are all kinds of things that
and look
happen.
At the complications you had from your hip.
Oh.
You almost died from those complications.
Well, I mean, thank you, universe, for saving me. I guess the universe felt I needed to still be here.
Well, and then there's contaminated needles. Anyway, the list goes on.
Well, the big things are really not addressed here. All the things that we do, and the underlying theme here, is why are we using such aggressive therapies generally in medicine? In the hospital, I can understand it. I mean, I did 35 years of work in the hospital where I had 5 or 6 patients a day, some of which were in the ICU and coronary care unit, and I managed them for the most part myself. I know that I helped a lot of people. There are many of those people absolutely would have died without the treatments that we did in modern medicine. And at the time, I was a conventional thinking doctor, using all the drugs just like everybody else did and thinking, oh, there's a new drug out. Let's try that one because maybe it'll be better than the other one, and I don't want to deprive my patient, and I don't care about the cost of things. I just want to help people. Well, that takes a long time to take a second look at and to get the idea that there are safer ways to do things than what we're doing generally. But in the hospital, I have more acknowledgement for their need. Outside the hospital, I see very little need for Western medicine. I think that should be the last choice, not the first. And many times we've talked about this
show. Unless it's an emergency.
Well, of course. I mean, you go to the emergency room and get the emergency treatment, and probably you're going to do very well. But in general, we overdo things. There are so many safe ways to solve problems and other disciplines that are not so aggressive, like Chinese medicine or acupuncture, chiropractic, homeopathy, all that have value and have been used for a long time. Yet,
and some of this is reflected in the difference in countries that have high or low income.
Well, that's true. And yet, at the same time, when you're looking at numbers like this and you're pooling them all together, you get information or suggestions or conclusions that may not apply to what's happened here in the U.S. You couldn't compare medicine in the U.S. with medicine in Uganda. I mean, it's going to be a totally different scale.
So what's the difference between the high and the low-income countries?
Well, there's a lot more medicine in the high-income countries and a lot less in the countries that are poorer countries that haven't yet.
So who dies the most?
Well, as it turns
the ones
out,
with more medicine.
Well, for every 100 hospitalizations, there were 14.2 adverse effects or adverse events in high-income countries and only 12.7 in low- and middle-income countries. So that tells you that the treatments that we use that are used in the hospital are maybe not the best thing all the time. I mean, why would more people die with more care? It's because maybe they don't need it, and maybe there are conflicts of interest, and there are secondary gains from doing certain things. And now that we have the new rules from Medicare and from Obamacare and for Medi-Cal and Medicaid, things are going to change again in a way where it may not be to our advantage. In fact, doctors are going to be restricted in what they can do when we have these electronic records that are going to monitor everything we do, and that is going to be part of what happens, that will be required if you want to get paid or you want to have a license. You're going to have to do that. What's going to happen is we will not be, first of all, getting reimbursement for the services we provide if the government doesn't think they're okay.
And who's the government? Is the government, do they have a board of doctors that
These are the regulators for Medicare or for the insurance companies.
So who
companies?
Are those regulators, I wonder?
These are, well, I don't know them individually. But
no,
these
but
are,
I'm wondering if they're doctors.
Some of them would be doctors, some of them wouldn't. But, you know, not all doctors are in a position.
Are created equal.
Well, that's a nice way to say it. That's really true. So when you look at electronic records, which will be in effect starting on January 1st, you try to do something that's outside the box, that's not conventional medicine, your patient is not going to be able to get reimbursed for the service. You may not get paid as a treating physician.
Could you get in trouble also?
Absolutely. You keep doing it, they're going to ask you what you're doing and say, this is not something that's approved. What are you doing, doctor? And if you continue to do it, they'll probably take your license. And then if you continue to do it, you'll probably go to jail. I mean, the new rules that are developing, that are governing the way medicine is practiced, are really narrowing things down to continue the status quo. And of course, that's what people who are in charge of all these programs want, because it's where the money is now. And it'll continue to be there until new therapies are woven into the system, and there are lots of roadblocks to keep that from happening. The beautiful example here is the photon stimulator. I use this infrared light in my practice. Very few insurance companies will pay for that. And it's an amazing technology that, to me, in the 50 years I've been in medicine, I have seen nothing that comes close to the unbelievable power and effectiveness in treating people.
Why don't they pay for it if it's FDA approved?
It's approved as a heat lamp, Vicki. It's
not. Okay, so it's approved.
So that means it's safe.
Yeah, so.
But it's not approved for diabetic neuropathy or chemotherapy-induced neuropathy or for sports injuries.
Even though
injuries.
You've been doing the studies.
Doesn't make any difference. The FDA isn't going to approve it because there's too much pressure from big pharma and the insurance industry
to keep drugs.
Well, of course.
You know, every time I go on Facebook, up pops an ad for something for neuropathy.
It's a huge business. They aren't interested in bringing the technology forward. They're interested in the money they're taking home. Yeah, it's about money. It's not about service. If it was about service and you could do whatever you wanted, and there wasn't a matter of getting reimbursed from insurance, patients would all want this. And that's why I don't charge very much for it. I charge $25, Vicki, for the use of the technology for 15 minutes, which is what most people need for a single problem. And, of course, that doesn't begin to cover the expenses for the equipment. I have $500,000 worth of equipment in my office. You couldn't begin to do that. But because I'm interested in helping people, and I'm not going to let costs get in the way, and if somebody has a neuropathy or another problem that needs to be treated by the light because there's no other way to treat it effectively, you think I'm going to say, well, I'm sorry you don't have enough money, go home, save up your pennies, and when you save $1,000, come back and talk to me and I'll treat you. What kind of a doctor would do that? And believe me, there are plenty that do, but...
Well, and the thing about it is that it's safe also, so...
Yeah, there are virtually no side effects if you've got any kind of brain on your shoulders.
So this is what we're getting at, that providing health care isn't enough. We need safe health care.
Well, yes, and we need to do what works, not just what's approved. And just because something is new doesn't mean that it's some kind of radical thing. And who promotes that it's radical? The people who are already making the money from the business that they're already in and don't want the technology to change. Because if it does, they'll be out of luck. I mean, what would the people who make Neurontin, make billions of dollars every year to treat diabetic neuropathy and other kinds of pain, how would they feel if all of a sudden there was no big need for that? And maybe instead of making $15 billion a year, they might make a few hundred million. That would destroy their income and create massive problems for their business. But what's the right thing to do? It's to bring forward the new technologies that are safe, don't have the side effects, and much more effective.
Well, you know, these statistics that we started out talking about, how does the U.S., do you think, compare with these statistics that are global?
Well, they're different. You can't, I mean, when they start talking about adverse effects and deaths and then lumping them all together, there are a lot of people dying of malaria and other parasitic diseases that are huge causes of death in the world. Those don't apply to the U.S. And when they start saying that these seven types of adverse effects that they were measuring only rank as the 20th leading cause of morbidity and mortality in the world's population, I mean, that wouldn't be the case in the U.S.
It's number one, isn't it?
Number one. Sure.
Killing people in the United States more from medical errors than from any other cause.
Not necessarily medical errors, but from effects of medical treatment, some of which are not errors. Mm-hmm. Because the drugs
well,
are
an
used.
Error if it kills them.
Well, looking back retrospectively, you'd wish that you hadn't done that. But it's something that has been studied and deemed by the authorities that this is safe treatment. Of course, who does that? It's a combination of the big pharmaceutical industry and the Fed and the FDA, which are in cahoots with one another. So that's why you see this as number 20 in the world, because they're looking at other diseases like malaria that are lumped into that. But when you look at the U.S. itself, when you've got 1 million people dying every year from the effects of medical treatment, that's far and away the most common cause for death. There are about 650,000 deaths from heart disease and maybe another 600,000 or 550,000 from cancer. It's almost like them combined is about the same as what we do with medical errors.
Well, this doesn't count the people that wish they were dead from the effects, because there are a lot of people that are sick because of it, or they're disabled because
Absolutely.
Of it. Absolutely.
I have some patients who have what's called Cipro-induced neuropathy, and I've seen several of them. They are miserable. There is no way that I know of fixing those people who have neuropathy. Nothing works. You're stuck using powerful drugs like Neurontin and Lyrica and antidepressants and NSAIDs and morphine and all this stuff. They're screwed for life, a lot of them. And how do you reimburse for that? The whole bottom line here is that we engage ourselves in approaches that are too complicated, that are not safe, and we do them because that's just what we do, because the FDA says that's what you should do. And the collusion that exists between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry is enormous, and it's in print everywhere. If you want the truth about what's going on, read my book, A Return to Healing. And in it, it's got a whole chapter on the karma of Big Pharma and why things are like they are. It's on Amazon. Get a copy. Every American, and especially every doctor, should read that book, because it gives the whole story of what's going on in healthcare that's such a big issue for us that we're not paying attention to.
And just remember that there is a time and a place for medical care.
Absolutely.
It's just that oftentimes it's a last it should be a last resort, unless it's an emergency.
Sure. Why use a sledgehammer to kill an ant? It's just making this, or an atomic bomb to, kill a cricket. Doesn't make any sense. Let's do what is the most sensible, starting with the least invasive therapies first.
And start with prevention.
Exactly. Wellness and prevention. Lifestyle medicine, right? Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo, here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on the salsa ingredient that purifies drinking water. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how do MDs balance home and work challenges. Let me tell you, that's a challenge.
Some people love cilantro, and I happen to be one of them.
Me too.
And other people just hate it, and it's been found that it has something to do with their DNA. But
really?
It's also been found that can be changed as well. But, cilantro is really healing, and if you do like it, try it instead of lemon or mint in your water, because it purifies the water. It removes heavy metals like mercury and lead and copper. And it's an antioxidant, it's an anti-anxiety herb, and it might even improve your sleep and lower your blood sugar. And some studies have shown that it has antifungal effects, and it's found to fight other harmful organisms. Cilantro is also known as coriander, and it's an inexpensive way of purifying the drinking water, according to the American Chemical Society. Now, personally, I like to add it to different foods for flavor. I put it in my vegetable drinks. Of course, it's good in Mexican food. You can make pesto with cilantro, and also that something to do with making the pesto and crushing up the enzymes releases something to make it so it tastes better for people that don't happen to like it because of their DNA.
Interesting.
But it's good in salads, and now it's good in our water.
Why not? Sure.
And, you know, it could be packed into tea bag packets and also reusable water filter cartridges or even tea infuser balls to remove the heavy metals. So add coriander or cilantro to your shopping list.
Right. You know, we use it in my practice, Vicki. I very, very rarely will use drugs to try and chelate heavy metals out of people. And I'll use cilantro and other kinds of herbs to help chelate in people who are toxic with different kinds of heavy metals.
I know I took a lot of it when I was having all my amalgams removed.
Mm-hmm. Your mercury, sure.
My mercury fillings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you think you want to be a medical doctor or your son or daughter does? Well, you might want to think again when you consider your personal life, because it really is a challenge to balance work and home responsibilities anyway, and especially in this profession for young women doctors working long hours and trying to have this peaceful family life. In fact, you know, when I think about other professions that can lead to burnout and to depression also, but when we talk about doctors, we're talking about possibly risking human lives. And it's important to have a good family life in order to be present and to do the best job we can at work.
Yeah, well, you're right. You know, our job as doctors involves human life, and we take it extremely seriously. And during our training, we're really encouraged to a point that's beyond what's reasonable to do everything that's possible to help people to survive. And that makes sense. How far do you go? When do you stop saying enough is enough?
Well, first of all, when we talk about priorities, I think that when you're at work, it should be a priority. When you're at home, that should be a priority.
Indeed, it
and
should.
And if things aren't going smoothly in one place or the other, it affects the other place.
Absolutely.
And this is why I think hospitals and other workplaces need to do more to support people with their family life. Like if they want to have childcare, for example, at work, or doing something about people's stress.
Well, look at the training we have, Vicki. I mean, in that training, none of those things happen. Doctors don't have time for recreation. They're not out playing tennis or handball or baseball. They don't have time for vacations that amount to much. There's no time for meditation or self-development. They're not reading novels.
Well, you know,
they're totally into what they're doing, and for an unreasonable number of hours. So you may see some doctors in training working 120 hours a week, looking at a seven-day week, which means that you might be on for 36 hours and off for 12 for weeks at a time, at least in the days that I was in school. Now things have changed a bit. But the medical centers are still abusing interns and residents that way. And when you come out of training like that after 6, 8, 10 years, there's a real issue in how have you learned to balance your life? Because there wasn't any. And then when it comes time to working with your kids and your wife or your husband, depending on who you are, it's a big shift and there's a lot of guilt that comes into play.
Well, also, you know, people might not think it's fair to treat certain doctors or nurses or other professions, whatever it happens to be, differently if they have a family. But I disagree, because I think that if you have a family, particularly if you have children, that should definitely be taken into consideration. For example,
well, for sure,
if your kids are sick, why can't you use your sick leave to stay home and take care of a sick child?
Mm-hmm.
Or what about holidays? Like, if you have kids, why can't they give you a little preference in having maybe Christmas or Hanukkah off because you want to be with your family, as mm-hmm. opposed to people that don't have children yet? Maybe they'd like to have it off too, but they've also chosen this profession.
Well, you're right, and that should be the way that it is.
But also shifts were a big bug to me, like when I was a nurse,
mm-hmm.
because if I worked some of those shifts, I wouldn't be able to be with my kids at all.
Right, right.
I mean, I'd be home when they were asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know, I could tell a whole story about all that, but we're supposed to be talking about doctors here.
Well, not just doctors, but I think that's right. And you look at the impact that has on doctors' lives, and it's huge.
And it causes a lot of squabbles.
It leads to lots of divorces
and
to alcoholism and to drug addiction, because it's hard to balance those things. When you look at even at medical students, 11% of medical students, Vicki, contemplate suicide. Try that on. Is there something wrong with that training?
Especially since they're supposed to be helping other people.
I'll give you kind of an extreme example. When I was in my internship at the University of Pittsburgh at the time, they had a fellow there who's now dead, so I can mention his name. They call him Black Jack Myers. You know, what a name for a guy who is chairman of the Board of Internal Medicine. And I'm there for about 2 weeks, and at the time, I was married before to someone else. And my wife at the time says, I'm going back to California, and I'm taking our son with me. Are you coming? And it was like, well, yeah, you know, I'm kind of in this program here. I'd like to finish it. And it created lots of havoc. So I went to Dr. Myers, and I said, Dr. Myers, I've got a problem. My wife is going to go back to California, and she's going to go with or without me, and I'd like to preserve my family. Can you help me secure, you know, an internship on the West Coast there? And he looked at me and he said, Saputo, you've got some promise, but I'll guarantee you one thing. If you leave this program, I'll see to it that you never pass your boards. And it was like, wow, what kind of compassion is that? And of course, that made it easy for me because I just said, well, thanks very much, but I'm leaving, and left it at that. And by the way, I've got his name on my boards, which I did pass several years later because I'm sure he forgot. But that kind of attitude in training for interns and residents and even medical students is outrageous. And we need to have a way to heal the healer. So people like Rachel Naomi Remen and Lee Lipsenthal, bless his soul, now dead from esophageal cancer, did a lot to help promote healing the healer. Because the wounds that we sustain during our training are very deep, penetrating, serious wounds that keep us from being able to be happy human beings. And it's why the divorce rate, the rate of alcoholism, of drug addiction, and of suicides is very high among the medical profession people.
Well, you know, when I was a nurse and I was a single parent, because I had gone through a divorce in those days also, mm-hmm. and I had a director the first time that was just wonderful, and she made it so that I didn't have to work one of the particular shifts because mm-hmm. of my children, because they were so young at the time. But then when she retired, there was another one that came on, and boy, was she a bitch.
Yeah.
And she actually sat and told me that she had to go through it, so why shouldn't I have to go through it? Just like the you doctors. Say a lot of times with the doctors, that they treat the residents and interns a certain way because they had to go through it themselves.
You're right.
And so I ended up quitting and getting a job at another hospital, having to give up my benefits and so forth.
Well, what's the most important thing to teach somebody in training or a young doctor?
Values.
Right. To be compassionate, supportive, loving, caring, being with. And if we listen and care and are present, it's a whole lot different than the kinds of things that happen to us in our training. And then we wonder why so many doctors don't listen and they don't care and they're bitter and life goes on as it does. It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about, does ownership of an MRI facility spur too many unnecessary MRIs? Stay tuned. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
If a doctor orders a test that he makes money on, do you think that he may order it more often? You bet.
Yeah.
Although he or she may have invested in it because they believe in it. Well, we're going to be talking about a study where patients with knee MRIs are more likely to receive negative findings if they're referred by a doctor with a financial incentive. In other words, a conflict of interest.
Right.
So how does this play out?
Well, it's just simple business. You know, you get into a routine where you're making a certain amount of money, and then you get trapped in that. It's like a treadmill. And it's easy to get into that situation because you want to provide for your family and yourself and be able to do all the things that money provides. And it takes you away from why you went into the medicine in the first place and gets you into the area of being a businessman instead of a doctor. And as most people know, doctors are not very good business people. And this is one more example of it.
So these negative findings are showing that a lot of them are unnecessary. And what's happening is that these unnecessary MRIs are driving the costs up. Well, so tell us about the study and the comparisons.
All right. Well, this was a study that was done at Duke University, and they had about 700 MRI exams, and they found that there was no difference in the number of abnormal findings on any particular MRI. But in those where there was a conflict of interest because of the financial ownership, about one-third more of the tests that were done turned out to be negative, didn't show anything, which means that they were much more liberal in ordering the test. Well, you'd kind of expect that. I mean, if somebody's got a financial interest. I remember 30 years ago when MRIs were coming into vogue, and a lot of the radiologists were putting up their own facilities, and some of the doctors were buying into it. And I wanted no part of it. I didn't join it because I knew that there was a conflict of interest there. And I didn't want to be in the business of medicine. I wanted to be into the service of medicine.
I'll tell you one thing. Medicare isn't happy about all these high costs.
Well, nobody's happy about the high costs. You're right. But we need to go back and remember what it is that drew us into medicine in the first place.
So how do we stop self-referrals when there are conflicts of interest regarding these financial benefits to the doctor?
It's not going to happen because it's like the oncologist, okay, who makes a certain percentage. Most oncologists who are in private practice, they sell the chemotherapy drugs, and they're more inclined to sell those drugs that cost more than they are to sell those drugs that cost less. So they're often promoting the drug that's the new one, which is still under patent, where there's a bigger margin of profit, and that's what happens. MRIs are no different. Cardiac echoes are no different. A lot of the technical
EKGs even.
EKGs
and the colonoscopies
even.
And pap smears.
Well, that's right.
Lab tests.
So we look at the United States Preventive Services Task Force is coming out, and they've blown the whistle on a lot of these tests and said, we may be doing too many colonoscopies, for example. Is it really clear that we need to do all these colonoscopies? Well, I can tell you that when my patients get a colonoscopy, within 4 or 5 years, they're getting a postcard back from that doctor's office saying, you're due for your next colonoscopy check. Why? Because that's how they make their income.
And the same thing, like we said, with the mammograms.
Sure.
And it's not just that.
You got to know that doctors aren't just greedy guys who are trying to make a lot of money. They actually convince themselves a lot of these things. And then when you see the discussions coming up, do you need a mammogram, for example, under age 50? Well, we're about the only country in the world that does that. The United States Preventive Services Task Force again says, we don't think so. And yet you talk to the radiologists and you talk to the mammography industry people, and they're all saying, well, of course we need to do that. Or talk to the chemotherapy people, the pharmaceutical industry.
They think it's malpractice not to do it.
Well, they would say that, and they actually make a case for it that makes you think about it. But there's always that underlying current that says, if you do more of these tests, you're going to be busier, you're going to make more money. And I'm not saying that doctors don't have a point when they're saying that some of these tests are a good idea, because they can save lives, but the question is how many? And is the test more dangerous than not? In the case of the MRI, there's no danger particularly. It's just a cost thing.
But I just don't think that we should allow doctors to own imaging equipment and labs
They're entitled to do business like everybody else. But I would agree with you, because of human nature in today's world, this is what happens far too often. And it's not like it always happens.
Of course, then people can throw that at you. Of course, we already discussed that earlier about the photon stimulator.
Well, that's right, except you can't accuse me of making a lot of money because I don't charge a lot of money for it. I mean, to charge $25 for a 15-minute treatment is unheard of. What can you do in medicine where you pay $25 for a 15-minute treatment with a technology that costs a lot of money? That's about service. So here we are in a place where we have to be thinking about, what are we doing? Is the world oriented so much towards business that that becomes the bottom line?
Well, how do we draw the line?
Well, the line is drawn by those who have the power. And the people who have the power are the ones that usually have something that they're selling, and they have money to start with. And they're willing to spend money to keep that power where it is, because they don't want to be a relic. They don't want to be an old technology. They don't want to lose the income that comes from that.
I remember years ago, a friend of mine that's a doctor told me that I should encourage you to do colonoscopies office because it was a great way to make money on the side.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, if that's what you want to do.
But then you're going to end up recommending colonoscopies to a lot of people.
Well, what do you think happens? I mean, that's right. You talk to most gastroenterologists, and you won't find too many that say, oh, it shouldn't be done as a routine screening test. They're not going to do that.
I remember years ago, I had a migraine. When I was a young nurse, I had a migraine. And there was this, and I was having some visual disturbances and whatever. And there was a doctor on the floor, and he was a gynecologist, and he wanted to do a pelvic exam on me. It's like, I got a headache. I don't need that.
Another one wanted
gastroenterologist, he wanted to do a rectal, and it was like, no, I've got a headache. It's this end.
Yeah, you know, it's yeah. I mean, people have different agendas, and you're a beautiful woman. That's easy to add up.
But my point, thank you. But my point is that they wanted to do what they know how to do.
Well, that tends to be the way things are. I mean, you go to the butcher shop, you're not going to order broccoli, are you?
Yeah, you go to a surgeon, they're going to recommend surgery.
A lot of the time, that's true. I use a surgeon who often does not recommend surgery, and that's why I use her. And she's probably the best surgeon I've ever worked with, and I've been working with her for 30 years now. And I wouldn't think of sending my patient someplace else first. I want her opinion, even if it's out of her field.
Well, if you're an orthopedist and you have patients that come in with knee problems, part of the time they're probably going to order MRIs, but like the study shows, if they own the MRI lab or facility or whatever, they're probably going to order it every time that somebody comes in with a bad knee.
Well, see, our world today runs on a business model. It runs on how much money do you make? The return on investment is the holy grail, and if that becomes clouded in a profession where integrity and healing and thoughtfulness and caring and supporting is what we should be doing, it pollutes it because of the inherent nature of how the culture operates. Until we change how we think and we become different in the way that we run our lives, so it's not just meeting our narcissistic needs, our self-centered needs, it's going to continue to be just like it is. We have to evolve past that and want to give and share and love and support and listen and care. Those are the words that lead to healing.
Well, I think that Medicare, since they're really not happy about this, and maybe the other insurance companies will do something about it.
Well,
eventually.
The problem is they're going to be doing too much about it. And then we've got a problem where there's over-restriction and where people don't have flexibility to do new things. And you'll be stuck with the manual that says,
That's what happens when something's abused. Then it goes the other way.
Well, that's exactly right. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. And it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on quotes from a friend. I can't wait to hear these because humor is the best medicine, isn't it? And when we come back from that, we'll be talking about what factors lead to early readmissions to hospitals. And lastly, is urban agriculture necessary or even realistic in today's world?
I have some quotes that I've collected from a friend, and one of them is from Mother Teresa. Some people come in your life as blessings. Some come in your life as lessons.
So true.
Yeah. Here's another one. A meaningful life is not being rich, being popular, being highly educated, or being perfect. It's about being real, being humble, being strong, and being able to share ourselves and touch the lives of others. It is only then that we can have a full, happy, and contented life.
So true.
These are some quotes on a coffee mug.
A coffee mug?
Yeah.
That is going to be deep. All right.
Some days the best thing about my job is that the chair spins. Yeah, that's one way to see the cup half full, though, you know?
Yeah. If that's half full, you got problems.
And here's somebody down in the dumps. She says, I didn't make it to the gym today. That makes 5 years in a row.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, this is an old guy's point of view. An old pipeliner, he says. Participating in a gun buyback program because you think that criminals have too many guns is like having yourself castrated because you think your neighbors have too many kids.
Oh, dear. That's beautiful. I love it.
You know you're getting old when everything hurts and what doesn't hurt doesn't work.
Oh, jeez. There's an outlook. Where's the half full glass there?
And here's one that's a quote for friends. We will always be friends till we are old and senile. Then we can be new friends.
Oh, right. That's like hiding your own Easter eggs, huh?
Okay, now that the government's getting involved in healthcare costs, more attention is being given to how to keep costs down. And some of it's also enlightening and helpful regarding what healthcare trends are helpful or are not.
Right.
For example, we already know that if a heart patient is depressed after a heart attack, it can predict a recurrence.
Right.
New research on patients with heart failure shows how their mental states and thinking abilities can predict early hospital readmission rates more than their heart problem.
Yeah. See, the interesting thing there is that the severity of the heart failure was not the predictive failure in readmission rate. So what is that telling us?
The body, mind, emotion, spirit, and how doctors need to be listening to their patients and caring.
They have to know them. You know, when I went to Duke to medical school, and I'm sure things have changed, at least I hope they have, they told me to stay objective, be a scientist, don't get involved with your patients, don't get into social engagements with them. You have to remain independent of them. And I was
thinking, be objective.
Yeah, well, I mean, how can you give somebody advice if you don't know them? I mean,
really know them,
and they don't know you. If they don't know you, how are they going to trust you?
So when's a doctor a healer, and when is he or she a technician?
Well, that's really right. That's what you're looking at there. And so doesn't it become our responsibility then, as human beings who happen to be doctors, to understand the situation that a person's in, particularly if they're going to offer treatment and advice? That seems like a no-brainer. If we don't really know what's going on socially with somebody, don't know their economic situation, don't know what their problems are, don't know how they sleep, don't know what's going on with their kids or their friends, how do we really know what's going on? And isn't physical disease the body's way of expressing psycho-spiritual dis-ease? If you believe that, as I do, then you must participate in engaging in knowing your patient from all these perspectives, or you don't know them. If you don't walk on their shoes, don't judge them. In fact, you shouldn't judge them even if you do. But at least if you walk on their shoes, you get some kind of idea of who they are and
it's
what
just
matters.
It's just that it's tough for doctors to do that when they only see the patient for something like 15 minutes.
Or less. Yeah, there's hardly time to go into things like that. But that's what's happening with medicine. We're being stripped of our medical care when we don't have doctors who have time to do this sort of thing.
It's so important for doctors to assess a person's depression, their anxiety levels, like you were saying, their spirituality, their mental functions, especially if they have congestive heart failure.
No matter what they've got, aside from any illness.
Yes, but maybe this particular study will bring this to the forefront for doctors to pay more attention if their patients do have congestive heart failure, since the ones that have congestive heart failure are being readmitted to the hospitals a lot sooner because of these other factors.
Well, look at the other diseases they have. I mean, 21% of these people had a central nervous system disorder. 70% lived with family because they couldn't take care of themselves. 25% had a psychiatric illness. 36% used antidepressants. 40% had cardiac disease that was coronary artery disease. 43% had diabetes. 86% had hypertension. Yada, yada, yada. These are sick people. Who understands them? Do you think that a myriad of drugs is going to control all that and bring people back into balance? If we don't know people and know what their situation is, how in the world are we going to really understand their predicament and have them learn from the misery they've gone through by having an illness?
And also, what's the relationship between emotional stress and cognitive impairment?
Well, it's very high. I think that they go together, first of all. And second of all, why do people get cognitive impairment? And now we get into real philosophical things here.
I've thought of that before, that it's an escape.
Well, it can be.
From a reality that they may not like.
That would be one reason some of the time. There would be many other reasons at other times.
Yeah, and there can be totally physical, mental. I mean, not a mental. There could be other reasons than mental. They could be the physical reasons, like plaques and strokes.
Well, I mean, why do those things develop? You have to ask yourself that question. Does the higher self of a person have so much power that it changes the biochemistry and physiology so that it creates dis-ease in the body that's a reflector back at what's going on at the highest level of the person's life so that they learn something on their psycho-emotional spiritual path? That's a big sentence and a big concept. And the scientists would say, you're nuts to you, you know, you don't understand medicine, you don't understand science. And I say that intuition and that spirit and those kinds of related factors are very important and inseparable from the science. I see science on one end of a spectrum, and on the other end of a spectrum, I see spirituality. And they are on the same spectrum, and 100% of the time, they're absolutely congruent. The problem is we don't understand it. And what we don't understand in science, we just simply don't look at. We throw out and say, well, this is BS, or this is quackery, or this is not science, this is faith, and we don't believe in that, so it doesn't count. Well, it does count.
It all counts.
Absolutely.
It's the whole person. That's treating the whole person, body, mind, emotion, spirit.
Well, that's thinking holistically, too, which is looking at the essence of the whole rather than the misery, I would say, of the parts. If you get stuck in a reductionistic paradigm where you're looking at the finger doctor and the hair doctor and the skin doctor and the eye doctor and the GI doctor, et cetera, who's looking at the person? It reminds me of a study of an experiment I did in medical school my first year. We started out with an egg, and we broke it down into different biochemical fractions, and I made this little chart of the egg. And it had the BGG and the RSD and the KAG and the SWD and all these little things. And I went back and looked at the chart, and I got to the top of the chart, and I said, what the hell is the EGG?
The egg.
The egg, meatball. And that's what happens, is we forget about the whole thing. It's a beautiful story, and it would have to happen to me. But it was a way of learning something that I wasn't going to learn unless I went through the process of that kind of reductionistic thinking about holism, which, of course, is an oxymoron.
This study also showed that there were some other things that influence readmission rates in these patients, like antidepressants.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Probably because the person's depressed.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, there are all kinds of psychiatric things that develop. Why? Because people haven't got their life worked out. They've lost their meaningful purpose. They feel defeated because things haven't worked out. They grew up in dysfunctional families, and they produce dysfunctional kids. And by the time they're older and senior citizens, they're looking back and everything's gone wrong. They haven't eaten right. They haven't slept right. They've got too much stress.
Well,
they weigh too much.
There's another one that they said was behavior. So that would include, would go under behavior.
Well, also, see, they've got a system here that I have to laugh at.
Well, they say substance abuse. Well, that follows too, because if you have substance abuse, it's probably related to some of these emotional things.
Well, of course. I mean,
but then coronary artery disease and central nervous system disorders.
Don't count those out, Vicki. Don't count those out. In my world, the way I think, those are absolutely related to our higher self. Absolutely. And I think they're there for a reason. I mean, why do we do the things in our life that we do? What lessons do we learn from them? We're going through life, okay, as a spiritual being on a human path, which has physical manifestations that are going to create challenges for us. And there's supposed to be opportunities to be able to learn from. And there are many, many people who think I'm an idiot and that's crazy thinking. And how could you be like that? But there are many others that aren't, and it doesn't matter to me if you agree or disagree with me. It's my opinion. And, of course, on our show, I get to say what I want.
You get to say your opinion.
And if you don't like it, you can send me an email, you know? Send me an email at drlen@drsaputo.com.
Uh-oh. Well, also, you know, just education and family participation can also, about all these things, can help to reduce some of these hospitalizations.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's about relationship. It's human relationship and how we get along in our lives. We aren't born with a manual that tells us how to live our life. We have to figure it out. And unfortunately, our parents haven't figured it out when we're kids. They may not ever figure it out. Some will figure it out when they're young. Most of them, maybe in their 40s or 50s, and a lot more in their 70s and 80s. It's interesting.
Well, parents are becoming older these days. You know, it used to be kids raising kids. Now some people don't even have babies till they're 40.
Anyway,
the healthiest, most nutrient-dense, and tasty quality foods are freshly picked, ripe, and eaten right away. And the farmers markets are a good choice for fresh local produce if you don't have your own farm. And speaking of fresh food, some fresh news is that some city restaurants are starting to plant their own gardens, which is a positive turn of events, but not without some challenges.
Well, that's true. And I think that's a good thing that we're seeing that, because we're learning that what you put in your body determines how well your body's going to work. You can't make things out of nothing. If you look at your body and your cells as a microscopic industrial plant, and you're making a car, if you're short a spark plug or a tire or a steering wheel or some other piece, forget it. The car's not going to work. You can't make something out of nothing. And your cells in your body are the same way. You don't give them the raw materials they need that are the right ones and in the right form, you're out of luck. It's just not going to happen.
Well, I think it's great that these chefs are picking produce the same day that they're cooking it in the restaurants.
Absolutely.
I would like a list of those restaurants.
Yeah.
I mean, the benefits are obvious, but there are a few obstacles. Things like, soil contamination, water, climate, atmospheric conditions, pesticides, and all that.
Well, they have to become farmers. I mean, this is what farmers have to deal with.
Yeah, and sometimes there's lead in the soil and in the water. And
lots of things can go wrong. They can make a crop not do very well or to come out with it. If it doesn't have good, solid stuff in the soil, where's all the minerals and the nutrients going to come from?
And even with the atmosphere, with the balance of the carbon dioxide and the ozone and the temperature and the humidity and the wind. I mean, think about it. If it's frozen, if it freezes and all that kind of thing.
Well, what it's pointing out is that we need to be doing more in the way of growing our own food. And we all can do some of that.
Yeah. And also, I think it's neat that some of the schools are starting to do that. I know where we live in Contra Costa County in the Bay Area in California, that Lafayette, they have a garden now where the people in that city are tending to the garden. I don't know how they arrange and work out, you know, sharing it or whatever.
The schools in Berkeley do that. The schools in Canyon, the schools in Orinda, you know, Wagner Ranch does it. There are lots of schools that are getting the idea that nutrition actually matters. I mean, think of it this way. If you have a nice, organic, beautiful broccoli and you put it in the refrigerator for a couple of days, it loses 50% of its vitamin C right off the bat. So fresh, healthy produce
that's
unrefined and not processed is what we should be eating.
Without additives or pesticides. That's right.
That's right. No,
and not genetically engineered either.
Well, that's for sure. Okay, so we're looking at some of the restaurants that are getting the message. And they're telling us, I'll provide this kind of food for you. It'll be a little bit more expensive, but a lot of people are going there. I mean, look at the people that go to Whole Foods. And we're looking at an enormous number of people who are spending an awful lot of money on food that could be
and everybody jokes
a lot
whole
less.
Paycheck.
Well, that is a joke that they talk about. All right, we're at the end of the show and want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7. On PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. Remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Absolutely. Lifestyle medicine is where it's going. We're with you. We'll check in with you next time.